You know, in my home state of Delaware is WVUD, 91.3
That's
FM.
Right.
It's on my radio. It's on our house.
The Vice President of the United States.
You're listening to the Arsenal for Democracy, forging and preparing a new generation for leadership. Now, here's your host, Bill Humphrey.
For 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. I'm coming to you on November 25th, 2014, from my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. This week, Nate joins me to discuss President Obama's immigration order and the bigger picture on immigration policy. Then, we examine Volkswagen's unionization efforts and Burkina Faso's pseudo-civilian government. All that is coming up right now on Arsenal for Democracy. Arsenal for Democracy is usually recorded in studio every Sunday and is available for download on Wednesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it from WVUD.org on Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is the Arsenal for Democracy. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me on the line instead of in studio this week is Nate. Nate, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Bill.
We're going to talk first now about the immigration issue and immigration reform. Obviously, I think most people are aware that President Obama issued an executive order last week that changes some of the enforcement and sort of deportation proceedings for some of the folks who are undocumented residents of the country. Nate, could you walk us through what this executive order consists of?
Yeah, well, I mean, this is something that I feel like the Obama administration has had in the works for a while now. And if I'm not completely mistaken, there was a similar executive order issued maybe like a year ago or and you'll have to confirm with me on this, Bill. But it was the beginning of Obama using sort of executive discretion in terms of how he wants to police the immigration issue. So obviously, barring some sort of legislative solution for, you know, the large number of people who are, you know, living in this country but lack, you know, citizenship or proper documentation. And so he just sort of going about it by maybe not looking to deport everyone and trying to maybe prioritize when it does come to deportations, you know, violent criminals and people who recently came across the border, things like that, instead of, you know, going into communities and just hunting down, you know, people who have been here for a long time and things like that. So, you know, as we've seen, the Republicans have sort of cried about Emperor Obama, but I would say this is probably more the result of the failure of Congress over the past decade to really have any sort of meaningful legislation about immigration and sort of just leaving Obama to, I don't know if it's fill in the cracks or just sort of a little bit of a sweep up to avoid, you know, having to undertake this like massive disruptive program of deportation that, you know, is sometimes being advocated by Republicans. So I don't know what your thoughts are, Bill.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, I'm broadly on the same page there. I think, you know, it's a first and foremost a question of the fact that it's not realistic to, even in probably the long term, but certainly not the short term, to deport, you know, 11 to 13 million people, however, whatever the number is now. And so given that circumstance, there has to be some amount of prioritization, which they seem to sort of reject that premise. It's not like they've even passed a legislation authorizing hundreds of thousands of more, you know, officers or whatever, or the money necessary to do it. Like the people and the manpower and the money and the facilities aren't there to do anything more substantial. So by definition, there's going to have to be some amount of prioritization. And so this seems to be a sort of more common sense way of doing it, although maybe it's a particularly sweeping executive order. And it's fair to have some amount of controversy over that, but there's only so much you can reasonably criticize with it, as you said, given the fact that they haven't done anything on this issue. And, you know, back in 2005 and maybe even 2006, George W. Bush tried to make a pretty substantial push on this with a Republican majority in both chambers, and he didn't get anywhere. So eventually, this is what was going to be the outcome, I think.
Yeah, and I mean, just going back to that 2006 just sort of debacle within the Republican Party on the immigration issue, where sort of Bush and the pro-business conservatives were beaten back by, you know, the more hardliners in Congress. And ever since then, it just sort of been a sort of steady devolution of the debate, you know, never really getting any closer than we were back then. And, you know, there's just a lot of pretty serious rhetoric on a lot of sides of the immigration issue, but especially from those people who are, you know, anti-amnesty, as they would put it. And, you know, whether there's like elements of racial panic thrown in there is, you know, another thing. But I mean, when it comes with the Obama, you know, decision, I guess to look at one thing would be like, instead of just sort of treating all cases equally as when it comes to like criminals or whatever, talking about maybe if you had a minor run-in with law enforcement, like a traffic ticket or something like that, that wouldn't necessarily trigger deportation. But like if you were a gang member, you know, a member of the cartels or something, it's like, okay, well, then obviously you're going to get deported. So, I mean, I think especially when we're talking about, you know, recent lawlessness and drug related violence coming over from, you know, Mexico or south of the border, wherever, you know, I think it's important that we sort of not get caught up in trying to, you know, deport just any undocumented person that you could ever find in America, which is, you know, really not that hard to do. And instead maybe focus on, you know, getting rid of the murderous cartel members or whoever who are, you know, just still, you know, located in America and, you know, carrying out whatever activity they want to here.
And speaking of the murderous cartels, I think there's also been a lot of criticism by activists and this isn't going to be affected by this order at all, unfortunately, about the fact that the border controls and the policies near the border are now so stringent that if you come over now without documentation and are caught, even if you have legitimate grounds for an asylum claim, which if you came basically through any other way, like if you came down through Canada or something and you got caught, then you'd probably be able to like make your asylum claim. If you get caught near the border, they pretty much just, you know, put you in a van and take you back across to Mexico right away. There's no procedure there, which is, you know, I don't know if it's, I don't know whose rules it's against. I don't know if it's like a UN convention or what, but my understanding is that that's questionable at best, sort of under international law and norms, and certainly in terms of human decency, because there's a lot of people who could probably qualify for asylum pretty legitimately. You know, and they're not necessarily coming through because they want to jump the line or whatever it's that they need to, or they're going to be killed. And we'll get into that issue a little bit more in just a few moments in this segment. The other thing that I wanted to bring up, though, regarding enforcement is that this was the immediate response that we got from a lot of these Republicans, besides, as you said, the sort of Emperor Obama claims. Was saying, well, you know, I think this was a mistake, that the enforcement side should have come first, or that we needed to do more, you know, we should have done more border security, blah, blah, blah. President Obama, and this is, you know, a factual statement rather than a sort of a opinion assessment here. President Obama has deported more people in the, you know, 6 years in office, I think even in the first 5 years in office, than any previous president had done. I mean, it was way more than George W. Bush, and a lot of those people weren't even the, you know, the extremists or the felons or the gang members or whatever. They were just average people, and they got deported under this administration. So I think that as with many policies, I think that he thought that going to that sort of hardline position, accommodationist position for years on end was going to somehow build a reserve of goodwill. I think that's proven obviously not to be the case. Nate, what do you think about this, the deportations issue, you know, that we've seen before he issued this order?
Yeah, I think that's been something we've noticed over the past couple of years, and especially early in the presidency. I feel like that was a pretty big issue, especially because he hadn't, really pushed forward on immigration policy yet. He sort of just skirted the issue altogether in the first term, whether it was because of, political reelection concerns or things like that. I think that's a pretty valid criticism. But I do just want to point out that then this is going back to the Reagan administration, that immigration and more specifically legislation and then the policy enforcement has just been a black hole. I mean, we're talking about, I think there was, and I'm trying to remember the name of the bill of the specific year, but I think it was 86, and it was a big immigration bill. And essentially, and if you, listen to or read the hardline anti-immigration, libertarians or Republicans or whatever, they blame Reagan for starting this issue. Like, Reagan doesn't get off the hook with these guys. Basically, they fault Reagan for never following through on enforcement of worksite programs that might be hiring illegal immigrants. So, just never really. So they passed a bill and then claimed that, they would try to get rid of the illegal immigrants who were already in the workplace. That never happened because obviously Reagan didn't particularly want to upset his business buddies. So, I mean, this has sort of just been a situation where, everything's just sort of going on under the radar in this sort of legal gray area. And I mean, when a problem has been this serious for this long and that there's just like an entire class of citizens who are living both within and outside of the law, I mean, it just doesn't seem like, that there's something that you can easily do to fix the problem. And so, I mean, I guess in this context, it shouldn't be all that surprising that even though there have been some attempts to, just change policy, that deportations are still high, just when there's not really any sort of policy regarding this, it's pretty challenging.
Well, and I think that your points about sort of the different factions in the Reagan process there leads us pretty easily into the wider big ideas segment that I wanted to do. So this is part of our series on big ideas in reforming American governance. And on the immigration issue, for a while now, the general view in Washington, unless you're one of the hardliners, the anti-amnesty people, has been, we need to do comprehensive immigration reform, strengthen our border, improve the legal immigration process, stuff about high-skilled workers. We can't deport the people, so we have to have a path to citizenship, a residency system, all that kind of stuff. It's been pretty, I would say, set for a while of what the sort of general outlines would be, whether or not the details have to be worked out. But what hasn't really been addressed is the wider issue of why this immigration is happening, what's a realistic long-term outlook for it, and how does this compare to how we used to handle immigration? And obviously, this country has been far, far from perfect on handling immigration for its entire existence. I mean, it's fundamentally the United States is a settler state. And, so most of the people came here from somewhere else or were forcibly brought here, obviously with the exception of
Don't forget about that part.
Yeah. And then there's the exception of the Native Americans who actually were here. But, by and large, this is, people who came from somewhere else. And certainly within the power structure, the white majority that has dominated governance, they're definitely coming from somewhere else, originally. But immigration is at its heart an economic issue. This is true in the United States. This is true all over the world. If we look at the issue of immigration in those economic terms, a number of things become very clear. The first of which is that as long as you have an imbalance in the economic prospects of one place, and a pretty substantial one, between whether it's Mexico and the United States or literally any, country A, country B, if country A has better economic conditions than country B by a wide margin, people from B will attempt to get to A at basically any cost. And we see this, you know, in the folks trying to get from Africa, whether it's West Africa or North Africa, or from Syria into Europe. You know, it's not, they're not just going because, oh, they want to get the free health benefits or whatever and the welfare. Like, they're going because the situation that they're leaving behind is so desperate that they're willing to pile into, you know, some really rickety boat that can't handle more than a few people, and they're going to try to get 100 people in there even if it capsizes. Quite tragic.
A lot of refugees, I think, have actually died making the trip to the Cape Verde Islands, trying to get to Europe.
The Canary Islands.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, no. Canary. Correct. So, yeah, as you said, this is it can be extremely dangerous.
Yeah, and so, you know, what we've seen with in the case of the U.S. and Mexico is that as the, you know, borders have been tightened, the controls have been increased, all that kind of stuff, that hasn't really had that much of an impact on the flow of immigration and undocumented immigration into the United States. It has essentially just pushed it out to more and more dangerous paths in, which means that, you know, we don't have the capsizing happening because we don't have this Mediterranean between us and Mexico. We have a desert and people are dying in the desert. You know, they're running out of water or they're being abandoned by smugglers in, you know, trucks in the heat and that kind of thing. Just all these awful stories, but very similar to Europe's experience right now with folks capsizing and that sort of thing. And I mean, you know, some people just try to write that off and say, oh, well, you know, they shouldn't try that hard, or they, you know, they should just suck it up and stay home. Like, which, you know, that's cruel and not compassionate. It's not a compassionate approach in the first place. But if you really look at it here, this is the example that I thought of the other night, which is, I guess, a fairly extreme way of looking at it. But if you think about the native Hawaiian population, right? Hawaii is in the middle of nowhere in the Pacific Ocean. And as far as, you know, archaeologists and historians and everyone have been able to figure out, the population got there essentially by leaving from Polynesia and just building, like, you know, a raft thing with a big sail and just saying, well, I sure hope there's something on the other side of this ocean when we leave. And, you know, if they had been slightly off course, they would have missed Hawaii completely and they would have run out of, you know, food and that kind of thing. And they probably wouldn't have made it to, you know, the other side of the ocean. Right. So and very likely a lot of people didn't. It happens that some of them did and they survived as that population. But I think that that's sort of a testament to the sort of that at a certain point, humans will get desperate enough that they will leave behind the conditions that they're in and do whatever it takes, even if it very likely is going to kill them, to try to get out of that situation and into a better situation. When the resources, you know, hit that limit in their home community, or it gets too violent or whatever, you know, that is essentially when things get so crazy that people will just, you know, leave all that behind and try to see if they can get there. So the idea that you can just sort of tighten the controls and that's going to be what fixes this problem, I think is really unrealistic. Also, what we saw in the most recent recession was that basically as soon as the recession started in the United States, the flow of immigration dropped off very rapidly. And I don't think that was because of, you know, deportations, catch and release, increased border security, increased fences, or any of those kind of things. I think that the consensus from the experts is that that was basically solely due to the fact that folks were not coming to the United States because the economic opportunities had been reduced. So, you know, as long as the U.S. is actually doing okay economically relative to these other countries and is less, you know, violent and more stable, there are going to be people coming across. So in that light, I think we need to sort of rethink how we approach this issue and sort of policing it, because it's probably better to manage it than to just pretend that it's going to, like, fix itself somehow, you know, or that we can just solve it through essentially force, basically.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, Bill, and really sort of underlies the economic just underpinnings of this, you know, entire issue, in the sense that perhaps this isn't the reason why more action has been taking on this in the past couple years, and, you know, why maybe has sort of flown under the radar for at least a little bit, just because I feel like when you had a booming economy in the U.S. and, you know, the housing bubble definitely contributed to that, and there were, you know, maybe a fair amount of jobs to be had, you had a lot of people coming over just because it was, you know, it was good employment, and you know, you were able to potentially get a better job here than you would have in Mexico. And obviously the socio-political climate is much better when you take in consideration some of the cartel things that have been going on down there. So, but when you have a situation in the U.S. where there's just not, you know, the with the economic crisis, and there's not, you know, a huge amount of jobs to be out there, I think there was something like a negative flow back to Mexico. So, you know, it seems like there were at least some people that, you know, it was very clear that the economic opportunities were the main reason they came to the U.S. rather than necessarily, you know, this is, you know, what they consider their home and they're looking to stay here forever. Maybe, you know, they're trying to, you know, maybe they have family in both countries, or they're, you know, primarily looking for economic opportunities that might not be available back in Mexico.
Yeah. And I think that's a great point, because one of the other things that I wanted to talk about was that sort of historical context, which is that I think we've had essentially a pooling effect, for lack of a better term, which is that the United States used to have, you know, obviously there were exceptions there. You know, we have the problematic history of the Chinese Exclusion Act and various other policies like that that tried to keep people out. But in terms of Mexico specifically, it used to be a much more open policy. And there's questions over how legal or not legal that was. But the de facto system for quite a long time was that seasonal workers could come over and, you know, work in the agricultural fields in places like California, all over the state. And then at the end of that season, they would all go back to Mexico. And the tightening of the border controls and, you know, making it harder to get into the United States, I think has had the effect of essentially saying to people, you definitely can't come through legally, and if you leave, you aren't going to be able to get back easily illegally, which meant that rather than people going home and, you know, not placing that stress and demand on the system and services that the, you know, hardliners are so worried about, rather than just going home, they stayed and did, you know, create that sort of year-round stress on the system. And we need the seasonal workers either way, and clearly the demand wasn't being met domestically. So, you know, it's more than just it's more than just companies shouldn't hire undocumented people, right? You know, oh, that we got to curb the demand for these workers, and that'll help with controlling the supply. Now, I think it's bigger than that. I think that we have to recognize this reality that there is going to be a sort of fundamental market-wide demand for a lot of these folks, and it would probably make more sense if they could come and go, you know, preferably legally and through some sort of a process. And, you know, there's various folks who are worried that that's sort of an exploitative system if you have one of those quote-unquote guest worker things. But honestly, I think that in terms of just assessing the realities, doing something like that, like we had in, I think, back in like the 1920s or 30s or so, that probably makes more sense than the system that we've arrived at, where they're going to come, but then they're never going to leave because they know they can't get back in later easily.
I mean, yeah, American immigration policy shouldn't be almost by definition, you know, contradictory and, you know, not incentivizing the right things. I mean, because the situation we have right now, as you just pointed out, is you can get in, and you can, you know, sort of evade deportation, then it's almost like you've won. You know, it's not, you know, if you have a job and are able to, you know, figure out ways around Social Security practices, things like that, or, you know, other types of things, it's almost like a drain on the system. Whereas if you were actually able to come here legally, register, or, you know, in whatever circumstance you want, you know, there's much more of a chance that your tax dollars or your output is actually measured back into society, whether it's through, you know, taxes or you not putting a drain on the healthcare system or, you know, whatever it is, it currently is not set up in an intuitive fashion in the American immigration system. And so we just kind of have this, as I said before, this little large gray area where, you know, you have people that technically quote unquote illegals, but it's also not smart to just try to round up every illegal person in the U.S. because there's millions of them, and it's just not good politics. It's not good policy. It's just not even worth really thinking about doing. And I think until we actually have a serious legislative debate that results in progress on this issue, you know, it's tough to see where it's going to go from here. And, you know, with a new Republican Congress, I don't really see that happening.
And we've obviously always had the sort of tension between the, you know, the nativists who don't want any immigration and the, you know, the people
know-nothings.
Right. The people who are very pro-immigration. That's been a long-standing tension in American politics. And, you know, another factor in that is that immigration has tended to concentrate both in arrival and subsequent settlement in certain areas of the country while leaving other areas of the country relatively, you know, not dominated by recent immigrants. You know, maybe they're several generations out, but they're not like, you know, quote unquote, fresh off the boat. And that also creates various tensions because then some people are more, you know, in sympathetic or less sympathetic, you know, for various reasons, depending on their sort of geographic proximity to the issue. But, you know, in the past, the United States has benefited a lot from having relatively low skilled people coming in, or at least a mix of low skilled and high skilled people. And the system, and there's been quotas and various, you know, ethnic or national preferences for a long time. But to my mind, in the second half of the 20th century, those increasingly got problematic. And why I think this is kind of needs to be looked at in sort of a big picture, big ideas way is that I think that we've gotten so hung up on the existing quote unquote legal system of immigration and how you do it legally that, like you said, you know, there's this rhetoric about having won or beat the system or cut the line and things like that. But then there's also this rhetoric about, well, we should encourage people to come here legally, you know, with high skills and stay here after they get their PhDs and things like that. And it's like, well, that's great. And I'm all for that. But do we really want an immigration system that only allows really high skilled, high education people into the United States and, you know, has no mix whatsoever and is basically just a reward system for other countries' elites to come and participate in the American system, you know, in the either our elite or the middle class, depending on, you know, where they land on our relative spectrum of economic power? It seems like the we've locked ourselves into a system that is sort of upholding the existing stratifications in the world rather than helping to rebalance that and sort of redistribute the, you know, global inequities and things like that. And that, to my mind, is also going to make the various problems worse. I mean, people are kind of cutting the line, so to speak, because they know that as a low-skilled person from Mexico, their odds of getting in legally are basically nil.
Yeah, and I think that's a great point. Just because the people that are able to get, you know, legal work visas are often people in, you know, highly skilled or highly specialized industries. And I think it's interesting if you actually look at some of those fields, there are Americans that are complaining about the immigration. So this happens even in the elite sectors of the economy as well. It's not just Mexican construction workers are displacing American construction workers. It doesn't really work like that. So there seems like there's very little reason to submit to the legal immigration system if you are not a high-skilled worker or if you are, you know, just, you know, an average poor South American wants to come to the U.S. for better economic opportunities but, you know, don't have some sort of specialized skill or degree that could help you get in through a specialized visa. So, I mean, I think in that case, I doubt that person is going to wait in line for years if, you know, an opportunity across the border is just a matter of getting across the border. And, you know, there's plenty of ways to do that nowadays.
All right. Well, Nate, we're going to take a quick break here now. Arsenal for Democracy will be right back in just a moment. You're still listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Still on the line with me is Nate. We're going to talk now about the story about Volkswagen that we've been getting out of Tennessee. Back in February, the German automaker's U.S. division, based in Tennessee, had attempted to unionize their own workers, which is obviously pretty unusual. And Tennessee happens to be sort of the union-free capital of auto production in the United States. I think there's been a lot of people pointing out lately that it's not so much a problem that the factories all got moved to Mexico as part of NAFTA. It's more that they got moved from, you know, Michigan, which until recently was, you know, a very labor-friendly state, down to Tennessee and a couple of the other southern states, which are not very union-friendly. And Tennessee is what's known as a quote-unquote right-to-work state, which is a bit of a sort of misnomer slash political misdirect. The right-to-work apparently being that you have the right as an individual employee to be your own personal David against your company's Goliath, and that you have the right to work outside of a union and negotiate all of those contracts for just you, all by yourself, which to my mind is not particularly a realistic outlook on the situation. But Volkswagen basically really wanted to unionize their workers, and this wasn't necessarily some sort of purely enlightened pro-labor position. It's that federal law says that if you want to have what's called a works council, which is a German concept, that you have to have a union in place, and it cannot be what's called a corporate union or like an in-house union. So Volkswagen cannot set up its own union. They have to have some type of external union, whether it's United Auto Workers or a smaller competitor or something, has to unionize within those factories in order, under federal law, to be able to have one of these works councils things. And Volkswagen has these in, you know, their various other factories, and especially in their German factories. And actually, most German corporations have this. And the sort of core concept of that is that you want to be able to have sort of a clear face for the workers that the management can negotiate with, and not just negotiate on things like contracts and collective bargaining, but also just sort of the little stuff, the day-to-day things about scheduling rules and overtime and, you know, okay, well, you know, we put this person in overtime before, who are we going to put in this time? Any of those sort of little things that kind of just make the workplace function a little bit more smoothly. That's a big feature in German corporations. Now, obviously, there's also much more sort of populist pro-labor policies, a little bit like the soccer stuff that we've talked about in the past, Nate, where, you know, where instead of the fans co-owning the soccer team, it's the unions co-owning the companies, right? That the members of the labor unions are sort of part owners of the company, and that also fosters a sort of pride in the corporation and all that kind of stuff. But the basic concept of the works councils is just, let's not have a giant combative fight over everything. Let's work together. Let's be in these meetings together on a regular basis, and not just when we quote unquote need something from the other side. Let's try to, you know, have a more cooperative effort here. Again, that's sort of a basic German corporate concept that's been in place for quite a while now. It's been legally enshrined under a lot of the post-war stuff in West Germany that's now all of Germany. But it goes back certainly beyond that. This was sort of their approach to reducing radicalism and you know, violence and socialist threats and potentially devastating labor strikes was, you know, let's do this cooperative approach. So they went back and forth about how they were going to unionize here. The Tennessee Republicans are very adamantly opposed to unionization, so they essentially interfered in the election. At one point, the United Auto Workers and Volkswagen United States jointly filed a lawsuit with the National Labor Relations Board against this interference. But, you know, they've managed to come to a sort of interim deal. Apparently, according to, I think, the Wall Street Journal, the union leaders were from the United Auto Workers were actually flown out to Germany to hold negotiations there rather than having them in Tennessee or anywhere else in the United States. So, you know, on the one hand, we're definitely seeing a very strong commitment from Volkswagen toward this policy. On the other hand, the sort of interim fix that they've worked out does not include collective bargaining at all, and Volkswagen doesn't necessarily care about that because, again, they wanted the union set up so they could do a works council, not so they could have collective bargaining, because financially it doesn't necessarily make sense for them to do that, even though I think that would be a good idea for everyone involved. Nate, what was your take on this overall story here?
Yeah, just a fascinating story considering that, you know, it sort of turns on its head certain aspects of the whole, you know, union business typical battle that happens. And, you know, it's just, you know, pretty interesting how the Republicans have sought to insert themselves into this debate, whether it's money from the, I think, Grover Norquist Americans for Tax Reform that was funneled into the election. So, yeah, I mean, I think, as you mentioned, it's not like 100% altruistic, like, oh, let's do what's best for our workers, even if it cuts in our bottom line. It's more of just a pragmatic, very German approach where it's just we're not going to waste our time and energy sort of bickering about, you know, the sort of the typical things that get sort of argued over between a business and its union. Instead, sort of trying to head things off by taking a more cooperative approach with, you know, members of the workers getting a say, having their voices heard on this works council. I'm not necessarily an expert in German corporations, so I don't know to what extent, you know, these works councils actually, you know, voice the wishes of the you know, your average worker, or what kind of impact they have in terms of determining policy. But it seems like, you know, this is at least a thing that is valuable to have for, you know, just making sure that there is a recognized and entrenched voice for the workers within the corporation. And it seems like, and considering that there's a works council in every single Volkswagen plant except for the one in China, apparently, this seems like something that is pretty standard and won't get completely ignored.
I think that this is a very interesting idea at minimum, and it's a good way of bringing this sort of model to the United States, which tends to have a much more combative and even anti-union outlook in general. Obviously, unions have shrunk a lot in recent years. You know, speaking of the kind of idea of it being a model, the United States Labor Secretary Tom Perez actually just apparently yesterday on the 24th of November just came back from a trip to Wolfsburg, Germany, which is where the Volkswagen global headquarters are. And basically, he wanted to see, this is according to Nashville Public Radio, he wanted to see the company's unique relationship with unions, which the automaker is trying to export to its Chattanooga plant. And he says, quote, "What I learned from my visit there is they really believe that a key to their success is making sure that their workers have a seat at the table." They call it co-determination. Well, they don't specifically. That's like the name for it under, you know, the English name for it under the German concept in general, where the union workers and the white collar management are working together essentially in this works council and even on the board of the company in Germany. Obviously, that's not going to be the case here. But he basically said that he hopes that this is a model for the industry in general. Again, as we said before, that's mostly in the South, but actually Michigan is now a right-to-work state, amazingly. That means that there's potentially, you know, going to be this situation coming down the pipeline there. So, you know, on the one hand, you get the criticism that the unions in Germany have essentially been co-opted into management in some cases. But on the other hand, they seem to be able to negotiate pretty effectively for various wages and benefits and generally just smooth things over and have a lot much less adversarial relationship. And that would probably be something good to bring to the United States. Now, one thing that I did want to talk about before we end this segment is the issue of the so-called Employee Free Choice Act, which was a bill that was proposed a number of years ago now, I think end of 2008 or beginning of 2009. This is one of these things that was meant to basically be a federal overturning of all these right-to-work laws at the state level or community level, but it didn't really go anywhere. And it's one of those ones that a lot of Democrats, especially in the Senate, wanted to push, not necessarily all of them, but a lot of them wanted to push. And that didn't go anywhere because President Obama was focused on the healthcare legislation. There was that sort of initial push for an economic stimulus, and then everything else essentially got thrown out the window in the effort to get that healthcare legislation passed, which obviously frustrated a lot of Democrats in Congress who had other priorities. Nate, I remember that a number of years ago when we had started our first blog together, this was something that you had written some stuff on. I don't know if you really remember following that at all, but you know, what the heck happened with that?
I mean, if I'm trying to recall specifically, I think that it didn't quite have the votes and it was just sort of dropped because it was deemed too controversial. Like, I think it was pretty close in terms of having the votes to pass, but
I don't think the administration really got behind it at all.
No,
either.
No.
Yeah.
Well, it was like nominal. It was never like full-throated, so I think that was part of the problem. Like, he said he supported it, but then it was just sort of kind of withered and died after that. But yeah, I think you were smart to connect it to the healthcare bill because, you know, sort of seemingly all the political capital was used on that. And I mean, plus, I feel like there's a lot of controversy and a lot of Republicans who are virulently anti-union and intent on establishing, you know, quote unquote, right to work, which is a interesting name if I ever heard one. For an anti-union policy. Right. So, yeah, I mean, it's just kind of your typical Republican, you know, bill naming or whatever. But so, yeah, I mean, it's just you'd like to see that happen. I certainly was interested in it when it was going – it was passing it or when it was, you know, being discussed in Congress. But at this point, it's tough to see that happening again just because of the current composition of the legislature.
Right. I mean, yeah, it doesn't seem like it's going to happen. But I think, you know, and that's another thing is I think there's some serious questions there, especially from the more left side of the party as to why, you know, President Obama had been elected largely on the strength of these unions that have shrunk so much. And, you know, not like that they were the only force, but they were certainly a distinct force within the party. And then he didn't really, you know, do anything to sort of help stabilize the bleeding from that sector. And maybe he thought that would be, again, like you said, too controversial, that it would be too divisive, things like that. But I mean, that's a core part of his base. And it seems like, as with the immigration issue and so many other issues, he just kept on kind of putting it off and not really wanting to engage on it. And at a certain point, at minimum, you're not getting anything done. And at worst, you're validating the rhetoric of the opposing side by not responding to it or by kind of tacitly embracing it and saying like, oh, yep, that's too controversial or too radical or whatever. And again, this doesn't seem like it's all that radical particularly.
Yeah, and I think this is maybe a little symptomatic of something I've noticed, at least for the past couple Democratic presidents. And this could maybe be extended towards the entire party or like especially in the Senate. But you sort of have these Democratic politicians give lip service to these more economic populist policies and ideas and just sort of rhetoric. But then when it actually comes to implementing policies that strengthen unions and, you know, are less hostile towards unions, it seems like it's not that they're, you know, stab these kind of bills in the back or whatever, but it's just a less than 100% or less than, you know, full passionate support and endorsement and expenditure of political capital. Because, I mean, there's obviously there's corporatist elements. Maybe they fear about donations drying up or whatever. It just seems like it's one thing to talk about it, but it's another thing to actually follow through and get stuck in on a political battle involving unions. And it just seems like there's still a reluctance to do that from a lot of Democrats, including Obama. But this goes back to Clinton as well and, you know, everything involved there. So.
Absolutely. Yep. Now, you know, we're going to have to end this segment here, but, you know, I think this is a positive step forward in Tennessee. I also hope that it becomes a model. But like we said, you know, the collective bargaining is still not there. And that's sort of one of the most important parts of unionizing a plant. And also the other thing that happened was that having failed in their bid to keep out the unions altogether, the anti-union side has effectively formed a rival union just for the people who didn't want to be unionized. And the idea there is that as long as unionization is happening in the factory, they want to sort of dilute that power of the United Auto Workers or whatever, make it so that there's, you know, a competing union that also has to be negotiated with, things like that. You know, that's a potentially troubling sign. But in general, this is a step forward. All right. Arsenal for Democracy will be right back in just a moment. Welcome back to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Still on the line with me is Nate. We're going to return now to a story that we covered a couple weeks ago in Burkina Faso. We talked there about the sort of mass protests that happened in the capital, resulting in 27-year presidency of Blaise Compaoré ending very abruptly and him going to Côte d'Ivoire. He is now in Morocco for a brief stay, apparently. We don't know the exact timeline of that. And we talked also last time about how ECOWAS, the Economic Community of West African States, had been pushing this policy for a democratic transition, or at least a transition to civilian rule very quickly, followed by a sort of a slightly longer transition to democratically elected government. And I think, you know, we raised some questions as to the efficacy of this plan and maybe even the credibility of this plan, given how many military coups and kind of semi-successful, semi-failed transitions there have been within the ECOWAS states itself, although there's also been a couple countries that have never had any military coups or illegal changes in power at all. But there was also mounting pressure since we did that segment from, you know, the United States or the African Union or whatever to just rapidly get back to civilian leadership. And there were some very promising signs initially. They did make pretty quick progress. They came up with sort of a transitional charter thing that was supposed to be very civilian oriented and kind of, it was an agreement between the military and various interest groups in the country and sort of civilian organizations and democracy groups and things like that. And it was going to guide them until the November 2015 elections. And then there could be a new constitution, all that great stuff. They also had this sort of interim council that was representing these various groups that was going to select their civilian president. And that was about the peak of sort of the ideal state optimistic situation. It looked like, hey, they're going to get through this transition faster than anybody else has basically ever done, probably. You know, it's going to be, you know, 3 weeks tops of military rule, and then we're back to civilian control. And then things sort of started to fall apart from there. They did transition to a civilian leader, Michel Kafando. He's the former longtime UN ambassador from Burkina Faso. He served most recently under the Compaoré government for 13 years in that position in New York. And then before that, you know, before the Sankara Revolution in 1983, he had served previously as the country's minister of foreign affairs. And then before that, as their UN ambassador, you know, the first time around. You know, so he's an experienced diplomat. I'm not sure exactly how much executive experience he has, but, you know, he has various relevant degrees and that kind of thing. But he's definitely worked with a lot of different governments and different factions. So that seems like a positive sign. Less so, perhaps, that his experience comes from two military governments and the Compaoré dictatorship. And also less so in that he was selected from a shortlist that was submitted to this council, not from the interest groups as planned, but by the military itself. And they apparently stated a fairly clear preference within the shortlist for picking him. So he's sort of the super establishment party the super establishment candidate here and the military's preferred choice. And his first action was then to appoint Lieutenant Colonel Isaac Zida, who had been in charge of the military government, as his prime minister during this interim transition. And the prime minister gets to appoint all the cabinet positions. And of the 26 cabinet positions, six of them, or about, you know, 23%, were assigned to either the military or, I think, Kafando himself. I wasn't exactly sure who got which portfolios there, but the sort of basic outcome there was that the mining ministry, which is important for the emerging gold mining industry in Burkina Faso, the communications ministry, which is going to control a lot of the information coming out of this government, the interior ministry, which will control all the sort of internal affairs and security matters within the country, The defense ministry, which obviously is governing defense affairs and external military threats, and the foreign ministry were five out of those six posts that went to the military or, you know, this Cafondo thing. And the word on the street is that essentially this was a very explicit deal that if they appointed Michel Cafondo as civilian president to sort of cover themselves from coup sanctions and things like that, that the military would then be appointed back into all the key roles in the country, including the prime minister's job being held by the actual leader of the military government. So that's where we are now in Burkina Faso, a very rapid transition to apparently nowhere different from what we had before. Nate, what were your thoughts on this situation and how it unfolded?
Yeah, I mean, just a little disappointing. It's never like a complete shock to see like an interior minister or a defense minister selected from members of the army, but considering the recent coup history at stake here or at hand here, it's a little disheartening, but I don't think we should have expected a quick transition to, you know, a peaceful democratic government. So it's just one of those things I think that probably happens usually during these types of, I wouldn't even say transition because it's not exactly clear the end point. But yeah, I mean, it just, you don't want to see this happen, but I mean, it usually does after a military coup.
Right. And especially, I think, in economically impoverished areas, the risk factors are even more heightened. To your point, though, about the speed of the transition and the reasonable expectations. Now, ECOWAS, as I said, had produced a sort of one-year roadmap that would get things back to civilian control and specifically democratic control. They were also pushing for a relatively rapid handover to a civilian authority such as Cafondo, although I don't think they envisioned it playing out like this. But I think the real problem here was that ECOWAS was being relatively flexible about it. The United States was even being relatively flexible about it. But the African Union insisted that this had to happen in 2 weeks or there would be penalties. And they managed to pull this off in 3 weeks, which, as I said, I'm fairly certain is one of the fastest transitions from, you know, dictatorship to military government to, you know, civilian government. I think, though, I mean, do you think that this was just pushing it way, way too fast, that even under ideal circumstances, they would have needed more time to do this properly?
Yeah, I mean, anytime you're sort of just like shuffling around the military leaders who had been controlling the whole government to just like the most important ministries. I mean, it just sort of begs the question of whether what they're actually trying to do and, you know, who they're actually trying to fool here. So yeah, it just, you don't want to see this happen. And, you know, I think it's going to be a while before we can, you know, take Burkina Faso, any sort of transition to democracy seriously, you know, if they still have these guys in power and making key decisions.
Right. And certainly they don't have a very well developed sort of civil society and political system, given how it's been single party, one man rule since 1987 and has been a series of sort of revolutionary and military governments basically since 1960. Again, this is, you know, we've just had the seventh coup in the country's history. You know, again, not a great sign, and it's going to make it certainly a bumpy ride. The last thing that I wanted to bring up, again, we talked about this previously, I think, Isaac Zida, who's now the prime minister and again was leading the military government, is trained by the United States military in various counterterrorism and security things. He was actually did a training in the United States, much like his sort of peer in some ways in Mali, who in a couple of years back overthrew the government in Mali, which then severely destabilized the country and led to a rapid Islamist takeover in the north and eventually a French intervention. You know, that guy was also U.S. trained, you know. And then weirdly, the United States, this was an article from the War is Boring blog on medium.com. The article there was saying that the United States has been pulling back on its strategic relationship, although France certainly has not been, with Burkina Faso. well before the current events, back basically since 2012, at least every year, the sort of U.S. investments in Burkina Faso have gone down every year. And these were largely military investments and security relationships. And they're basically pulling back to Niger, neighboring Niger, on the grounds that Niger is, quote unquote, more stable. Although that's a little bit baffling, considering that Niger had a military coup in 2010. You know, did you have any sort of reaction on that particular angle here about the U.S. sort of strategic and military involvement in the country?
Well, as we all know, the U.S. has a pretty long history of, you know, I would say close, cozy cooperation with, you know, sort of military-led governments. Just sort of depends on certain other factors with the military, not necessarily whether they're a junta or not. But yeah, I think it's smart for the U.S. to sort of take a step back and, you know, sort of reassess their relationship if this is going to continue to be a military-influenced government. I can't really say it's a military government now, I guess, but I mean, it's certainly not looking like it's all that, you know, civilian-run and, you know, full of checks and balances and independent of the influence of the armed forces. So, you know, I'd like to see the U.S. continue a relationship, you know, whether it's strategically, economically, whatever, with Burkina Faso, but it's just a little concerning currently.
All right. Well, Nate, thank you so much for joining me again this week to talk about all these issues.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Bill.
And that's all the time we have this week. Thanks for listening to Arsenal for Democracy. Tweet us your comments at AFDRadio or email AFDRadio@gmail.com. The show is available for download from ArsenalForDemocracy.com on Wednesdays. You can also hear it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark every Wednesday night at 6 p.m. Eastern. Special thanks to my voiceover man, Justin. You can follow his work at the Digitized Ramblings of an 8-Bit Animal from 8BitAnimal.com. You can get additional commentary at ArsenalForDemocracy.com daily, as well as links to articles discussed today. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message. Good night.